This had better work, Jeremy, or my last will and testament says that my whole estate goes into putting a bounty on your head. Speaking of which...
The defence professor reached again into his robes and tossed the witch a bag that made a clinking sound. The witch caught it, weighed it, made a pleased sound. Then she stood up, and the pale skeletal woman floated off the ground beside her.
"I'm heading back," said the witch. "I can't start my work here."
"Wait,"
said the defence professor, and with a gesture retrieved his wand from Bellatrix's hand and harness. Then his hand pointed the wand at Bellatrix and moved in a small circular gesture, accompanied by a quiet,
"Obliviate."
"That's it," snapped the witch. "I'm taking her out of here before anyone does her any more damage."
One arm came around to hug the bony form of Bellatrix Black to her side, and they both disappeared with the loud pop of apparition. And there was silence in that lumpy place, but for the gentle rush of the passing waves and a little breath of wind.
"I think the performance is finished," said the inner critic. "I give it 2.5 out of 5 stars. She's probably not a very experienced actor. I wonder if a real healer would seem more fake than an actor told to play one,"
mused Ravenclaw. "Like watching a television show." That was how it felt. "Like watching a television show whose characters you didn't particularly empathize with." That was all that could be seen and felt from behind the glass walls. Somehow, Harry managed to move his lips himself, send his own voice out into the still dawn air, and then was surprised to hear his own question.
"How many different people are you, anyway?"
The pale man lying on the ground didn't laugh, but from the broomstick, Harry's eyes saw the sides of Professor Quirrell's lips curling up, the edge of that familiar, sardonic smile.
"I cannot say that I bothered keeping count. How many are you?"
It shouldn't have shaken the inner Harry so much, hearing that response. And yet he felt... he felt unstable, like his own centre had been subtracted.
"Oh, excuse me," said Harry's voice.
It now sounded as distant and detached as the fading Harry felt.
"I'm going to faint in a few seconds, I think."
"Use the 4th portkey I gave you. The one I said was our fallback refuge,"
said the man lying on the ground, calmly but swiftly.
"It will be safer there, and continue wearing your cloak."
Harry's free hand retrieved another twig from his pouch and snapped it. There was another portkey yank, internationally long, and then he was somewhere black.
"Lumos,"
said Harry's lips, some part of him looking out for the safety of the whole. He was inside what looked like a muggle warehouse, a deserted one. Harry's legs climbed off the broomstick, lay on the floor. His eyes closed, and some tiny fraction of self willed his light to fail before the darkness took him.
"Where will you go?"
yelled Amelia. They were almost at the edge of the wards.
"Backward in time to protect Harry Potter," said the old wizard,
and before Amelia could even open her lips to ask if he wanted help, she felt the boundary of the wards as they crossed them. There was a pop of apparition, and the wizard and the phoenix vanished, leaving behind the borrowed broomstick.
Chapter 60. The Stanford Prison Experiment, Part 10.
Wake!
Harry's eyes flew open as he came awake with a choking gasp, a jerking start of his prone body. He couldn't remember any dreams. Maybe his brain had been too exhausted to dream. It seemed like he'd only closed his eyes and then heard that word spoken a moment after.
"You must awaken,"
said the voice of Quirinus Quirrell.
"I gave you as much time as I could, but it would be wise to reserve at least one use of your time, Turner. Soon, we must go backward 4 hours to Mary's place, appearing in every way as though we have done nothing interesting this day. I wish to speak to you before then."
Harry slowly sat up in the midst of darkness. His body ached, and not only in the places where it had laid on the hard concrete. Images tumbled over each other in his memory, everything his unconscious brain had been too tired to discharge into a proper nightmare. 12 terrible voids floating down a metal corridor, tarnishing the metal around them. Light dimmed and temperature falling as the emptiness tried to suck all life out of the world. Chalk-white skin stretched just above the bone that had remained after fat and muscle faded. A metal door. A woman's voice.
"No, I didn't mean it. Please don't die."
"What was that place?"
Harry said hoarsely, in a voice pushed out of his throat like water forced through a too thin pipe. In the darkness, it sounded almost as shattered as Bellatrix Black's voice had been.
"What was that place? That wasn't a prison. That was hell!"
"Hell,"
said the calm voice of the defense professor.
"You mean the Christian punishment fantasy? I suppose there is a similarity."
"How?"
Harry's voice was blocking. There was something huge lodged in his throat.
"How? How could they? People had built that place. Someone had made Azkaban. They'd made it on purpose. They'd done it deliberately. That woman, she'd had children. Children she wouldn't remember. Some judge had decided for that to happen to her. Someone had needed to drag her into that cell and lock its door while she screamed. Someone fed her every day and walked away without letting her out." "How could people do that?"
"Why shouldn't they?" said the defense professor.
A pale blue light lit the warehouse then, showing a high, cavernous concrete ceiling and a dusty concrete floor, and Professor Quirrell sitting some distance away from Harry, leaning his back against a painted wall. The pale blue light turned the walls to glacier surfaces, the dust on the floor to speckled snow, and the man himself had become an ice sculpture, shrouded in darkness where his black robes lay over him.
"What use are the prisoners of Azkaban to them?"
Harry's mouth opened in a croak. No words exited. A faint smile twitched on the defense professor's lips.
"You know, Mr. Potter, if he who must not be named had come to rule over magical Britain and built such a place as Azkaban, He would have built it because he enjoyed seeing his enemies suffer. And if, instead, he began to find their suffering distasteful, why, he would order Azkaban torn down the next day. As for those who did make Azkaban, and those who do not tear it down while preaching lofty sermons and imagining themselves not to be villains, well, Mr. Potter, I think if I had my choice of taking tea with them or taking tea with you-know-who, I should find my sensibilities less offended by the Dark Lord.
I don't understand,
Harry said. His voice was shaking. He'd read about the classic experiment on the psychology of prisons. The ordinary college students who had turned sadistic as soon as they were assigned the role of prison guards. Only now he realized that the experiment hadn't examined the right question, the one most important question. They hadn't looked at the key people. Not the prison guards, but everyone else.
I really don't understand, Professor Quirrell. How can people just stand by and let this happen? Why is the country of magical Britain doing this?
Harry's voice stopped. The defense professor's eyes appeared to be the same color as always, in the pale blue light, for that light was the same color as Quirinus Quirrell's irises, those never-thawing chips of ice.
Welcome, Mr. Potter, to your first encounter with the realities of politics. What do the wretched creatures in Azkaban have to offer any faction? Who would benefit from aiding them? A politician who openly sided with them would associate themselves with criminals, with weakness, with distasteful things that people would rather not think about. Alternatively, the politician could demonstrate their might and cruelty by calling for longer sentences. To make a display of strength requires a victim to crush beneath you, after all. And the populace applauds, for it is their instinct to back the winner.
A coldly amused laugh.
Ha ha! You see, Mr. Potter, no one ever quite believes that they will go to Azkaban. So they see no harm in it for themselves. As for what they inflict on others, I suppose you were once told that people care about that sort of thing. It is a lie, Mr. Potter. People don't care in the slightest, and if you had not led a vastly sheltered childhood, you would have noticed that long ago. Console yourself with this. Those now prisoner in Azkaban voted for the same ministers of magic who pledged to move their cells closer to the Dementors. I admit, Mr. Potter, that I see little hope for democracy as an effective form of government, but I admire the poetry of how it makes its victims complicit in their own destruction.
Harry's recently cohered self was threatening to shatter into fragments again, the words falling like hammer strikes on his consciousness, driving him back, step by step, over the precipice where lurked some vast abyss. And he was trying to find something to save himself, some clever retort that would refute the words. But it did not come. The defense professor watched Harry. the gaze reflecting more curiosity than command.
"It is very simple, Mr. Potter, to understand how Azkaban was built, and how it continues to be. Men care for what they themselves expect to suffer or gain, and so long as they do not expect it to redound upon themselves, their cruelty and carelessness is without limit. All the other wizards of this country are no different within than he who sought to rule over them. You know who. They only lack his power and his frankness."
The boy's hands were clenched into fists so tightly that the nails cut into his palm. If his fingers were white or his face was pale, you couldn't have seen that, for the dim blue light cast all into ice or shadow.
"You once offered to support me, if my ambition were to be the next Dark Lord. Is that why, Professor?"
The defense professor inclined his head, a thin smile on his lips.
"Learn all that I have to teach you, Mr. Potter, and you will rule this country in time. Then you may tear down the prison that democracy made, if you find that Azkaban still offends your sensibilities. Like it or not, Mr. Potter, you have seen this day that your own will conflicts with the will of this country's populace, and that you do not bow your head and submit to their decision when that occurs. So, to them, whether or not they know it, and whether or not you acknowledge it, you are their next Dark Lord."
In the monochromatic light, unwavering, the boy and the defense professor both seemed like motionless ice sculptures, the irises of their eyes reduced to similar colors, looking very much the same in that light. Harry stared directly into those pale eyes. All the long-suppressed questions, the ones he'd told himself he was putting on hold until the Ides of May. That had been a lie. Harry now knew. A self-deception. He'd kept silent for fear of what he might hear. And now, everything was coming forth from his lips, all at once.
"On our first day of class, you tried to convince my classmates I was a killer."
"You are," amusedly. "But if your question is why I told them that, Mr. Potter, the answer is that you will find ambiguity a great ally on your road to power. Give a sign of Slytherin on one day, and contradict it with a sign of Gryffindor the next, and the Slytherins will be enabled to believe what they wish, while the Gryffindors argue themselves into supporting you as well. So long as there is uncertainty, people can believe whatever seems to be to their own advantage. And so long as you appear strong, so long as you appear to be winning, their instincts will tell them that their advantage lies with you. Walk always in the shadow, and light and darkness both will follow."
"And," said the boy, his voice level, "just what do you want out of all this?"
Professor Quirrell had leaned further back against the wall from where he sat, casting his face into shadow, his eyes changing from pale ice into dark pits like those of his snake form.
"I wish for Britain to grow strong under a strong leader. That is my desire. As for my reasons why..."
Professor Quirrell smiled without mirth.
I think they shall stay my own.
The sense of doom that I feel around you.
The words were becoming harder and harder to say as the subject danced closer and closer to something terrible and forbidden.
You always knew what it meant.
I had several guesses,
said Professor Quirrell, his expression unreadable.
And I will not yet say all I guessed, but this much I will tell you. It is your doom which flares when we come near, not mine.
For once, Harry's brain managed to mark this as a questionable assertion and possible lie, instead of believing everything it heard.
Why do you sometimes turn into a zombie?
Personal reasons,
said Professor Quirrell, with no humour at all in his voice.
What was your ulterior motive for rescuing Bellatrix?
There was a brief silence, during which Harry tried hard to control his breathing, keep it steady. Finally, the defence professor shrugged, as though it were of no account.
I all but spelled it out for you, Mr. Potter. I told you everything you needed to deduce the answer. If you had been mature enough to consider that first obvious question. Bellatrix Black was the Dark Lord's most powerful servant, her loyalty the most assured. She was the single person most likely to be entrusted with some part of the Lost Law of Slytherin that should have been yours.
Slowly, the anger crept over Harry. Slowly, the wrath. Something terrible beginning to boil in his blood. In just a few moments, he would say something that he really shouldn't say while the two of them were alone in a deserted warehouse.
But she was innocent, said the defense professor.
He was not smiling.
And the degree to which all her choices were taken away from her, so that she never had a chance to suffer for her own mistakes, it struck me as excessive, Mr. Potter. If she tells you nothing of use,
the defense professor gave another small shrug,
I shall not consider this day's work a waste.
How altruistic of you,
Harry said coldly.
So, if all wizards are like you-know-who inside, are you an exception to that, then?
The defense professor's eyes were still in shadow, dark pits that could not be met.
Call it a whim, Mr. Potter. It has sometimes amused me to play the part of a hero. Who knows but that you know who would say the same?
Harry opened his mouth a final time, and found that he couldn't say it. He couldn't ask the last question. The last and most important question. He couldn't make the words come out. Even though a refusal like that was forbidden to a rationalist, for all that it ever recited the litany of Tarski, or the litany of Gendolin, or sworn that whatever could be destroyed by the truth should be, in that one moment, couldn't bring himself to say his last question out loud. Even though he knew he was thinking wrongly, even though he knew he was supposed to be better than this, he still couldn't say it.
Now it is my turn to inquire of you.
Professor Quirrell's back straightened from where it had leaned back against the glacier wall of painted concrete.
I was wondering, Mr. Potter, if you had anything to say about nearly killing me and ruining our mutual endeavour. I am given to understand that an apology in such cases, is considered a sign of respect. But you have not offered me one. Is it just that you have not yet gotten around to it, Mr. Potter?"
The tone was calm, the quiet edge so fine and sharp that it would slice all the way through you before you realized you were being murdered. And Harry just looked at the defense professor with cool eyes that would never flinch from anything. Not even death now. He was no longer in Azkaban. No longer fearful of the part of him that was fearless. And the solid gemstone that was Harry had rotated to meet the stress, turning smoothly from one facet to another, from
a calculated
light
play on his
to
part
darkness,
to make me feel guilty,
to cold,
put me in a position where I must submit. A genuine emotion on his part.
"I see," said Professor Quirrell. "I suppose that answers..."
"No,"
said the boy in a cool, collected voice.
"You don't get to frame the conversation that easily, Professor. I went to considerable lengths to protect you and get you out of Azkaban safely, after I thought you had tried to kill a police officer. That included facing down 12 Dementors without a Patronus charm. I wonder, if I had apologized when you demanded it, would you have said thank you in turn? Or am I correct in thinking it was my submission you demanded there, and not only my respect?"
There was a pause, and then Professor Quirrell's voice came in reply, openly icy with danger no longer veiled.
"It seems you still cannot bring yourself to lose, Mr. Potter."
Darkness stared out of Harry's eyes without flinching, the defense professor himself reduced to a mortal thing within them.
"Oh, and are you pondering now whether you should pretend to lose to me and pretend to humble yourself before my own anger, in order to preserve your own plans? Did the thought of a calculated false apology even cross your mind? Me neither, Professor Quirrell."
The defense professor laughed, low and humorless, emptier than the void between the stars, dangerous as any vacuum filled with hard radiation.
"No, Mr. Potter, you have not learned your lesson. Not at all."
"I thought of losing many times in Azkaban," said the boy, his voice level. "I thought I ought to simply give up and turn myself over to the Aurors. Losing would have been the sensible thing to do. I heard your voice saying it to me in my mind, and I would have done it, if I had been there by myself. But I couldn't bring myself to lose you."
There was silence then, for a time, as though even the defense professor couldn't quite think of what to say to that.
"I am curious," said Professor Quirrell at last. "What do you think that I should apologize for, precisely? I gave you explicit instructions in the event of a fight. You were to stay down, stay out of the way, cast no magic. You violated those instructions and brought down the mission."
"I made no decision," the boy said evenly. "There was no choice in it. Only a wish that the Aura should not die, and my Patronus was there. For that wish to have never occurred, you should have warned me that you might bluff using a killing curse. By default, I assume that if you point your wand at someone and say Avada Kedavra, it is because you want them dead. Shouldn't that be the first rule of unforgivable curse safety?
Rules are for duels,
said the defense professor. Some of the coldness had returned to his voice.
And dueling is a sport, not a branch of battle magic. In a real fight, a curse which cannot be blocked and must be dodged is an indispensable tactic. I would have thought this obvious to you, but it seems I misjudged your intellect.
It also seems to me imprudent, said the boy,
continuing as though the other had not spoken,
to not tell me that my casting any spell on you might kill us both. What if you had suffered some mishap, and I had tried an innovate, or a hover charm? That ignorance, which you permitted for purposes I cannot guess, played also some part in this catastrophe.
There was another silence. The defense professor's eyes had narrowed, and there was a faintly puzzled look on his face, as though he had encountered some completely unfamiliar situation. And still the man spoke no word.
Well,
said the boy. His eyes had not wavered from the defense professor's.
I certainly regret hurting you, Professor, but I do not think the situation calls for me to submit to you. I never really did understand the concept of apology, still less as it applies to a situation like this. If you have my regrets, but not my submission, does that count as saying sorry?
Again that cold, cold laugh, darker than the void between the stars.
I wouldn't know, said the defense professor. I, too, never understood the concept of apology. That ploy would be futile between us, it seems, with both of us knowing it for a lie. Let us speak no more of it, then. Debts will be settled between us in time.
There was silence for a time.
By the way, said the boy, Hermione Granger would never have built Azkaban, no matter who was going to be put in it, and she'd die before she hurt an innocent. Just mentioning that, since you said before that all wizards are like you-know-who inside, and that's just false as a point of simple fact. Would have realized it earlier if I hadn't been.
The boy gave a brief, grim smile.
Stressed out.
The defense professor's eyes were half-lidded, his expression distant.
People's insides are not always like their outsides, Mr. Potter. Perhaps she simply wishes others to think of her as a good girl. She cannot use the Patronus charm.
Ha ha!
Said the boy. His smile seemed realer now, warmer.
She's having trouble for exactly the same reason I did. There's enough light in her to destroy Dementors, I'm sure. She wouldn't be able to stop herself from destroying Dementors, even at the cost of her own life.
The boy trailed off, and then his voice resumed.
I might not be such a good person. Maybe. But they do exist, and she is one of them.
Dryly.
She is young, and to make a show of kindness costs her little.
There was a pause at this. Then the boy said,
Professor, I have to ask, when you see something all dark and gloomy, doesn't it ever occur to you to try and improve it somehow? Like, yes, something goes terribly wrong in people's heads that makes them think it's great to torture criminals, but that doesn't mean they're truly evil inside, and maybe if you taught them the right things, showed them what they were doing wrong, you could change.
Professor Quirrell laughed then, and not with the emptiness of before.
Ha ha! Ah, Mr. Potter, sometimes I do forget how very young you are. Sooner, you could change the colour of the sky.
Another chuckle, this one colder.
And the reason it is easy for you to forgive such fools and think them well, Mr. Potter, is that you yourself have not been sorely hurt. You will think less fondly of commonplace idiots after the first time their folly costs you something dear, such as 100 galleons from your own pocket, perhaps, rather than the agonizing deaths of 100 strangers.
The defense professor was smiling thinly. He took a pocket watch out of his robes, looked at it.
Let us depart now, if there is nothing more to say between us.
You don't have any questions about the impossible things I did to get us out of Azkaban?
No, said the defense professor. I believe I have solved most of them already. As for the rest, it is too rare that I find a person whom I cannot see through immediately, be they friend or foe. I shall unravel the puzzles about you for myself in due time.
The defense professor shoved himself up, pushing back on the wall with both hands and rising to his feet, smoothly, if too slowly. The boy, less gracefully, did the same. And the boy blurted out the last, most terrible question, which he had earlier been unable to ask, as though to say it aloud would make it real, and as though it were not already vastly obvious.
Why am I not like the other children my own age?
In a deserted side road of Diagon Alley, where scraps of unvanished trash could be seen lodged into the edges of the brick street and the blank brick building sides that surrounded it, along with scattered dirt and other signs of neglect, an ancient wizard and his phoenix apparated into existence. The wizard was already reaching within his robes for his hourglass when, in habit, his eyes jumped to a random spot between the road and the wall to memorize it. And the old wizard blinked in surprise. There was a scrap of parchment in that spot. A frown crossed Albus Dumbledore's face as he took a step forward and took the crumpled scrap, unfolding it. On it was a single word. No. And nothing more. Slowly, the wizard let it flutter from his fingers. Absently, he reached down to the pavement and picked up the nearest scrap of parchment, which looked remarkably similar to the one he had just taken. He touched it with his wand, and a moment later it was inscribed with the same word, No, in the same handwriting, which was his own. The old wizard had planned to go back 3 hours to when Harry Potter first arrived in Diagon Alley. He had already watched, upon his instruments, the boy leaving Hogwarts, and that could not be undone. His one attempt to fool his own instruments, and so control time without altering its appearance to himself, had ended in sufficient disaster to convince him to never again try such trickery. He had hoped to retrieve the boy at the first possible moment after his arrival and take him to another safe location. If not Hogwarts, for his instruments had not shown the boy's return. But now,
a paradox, if I retrieve him immediately after he arrives in Diagon Alley,
murmured the old wizard to himself.
Perhaps they did not set in motion their plan to rob Azkaban until after they had confirmed his arrival here. Or else, perhaps.
Painted concrete, hard floor and distant ceilings, 2 figures facing off across from each other. One entity, who wore the shape of a man in his late 30s, and already balding, and another mind that wore the form of an 11-year-old boy with a scar upon his forehead. Ice and shadow. Pale blue light.
"I don't know," said the man.
The boy just looked at him, and then said,
"Oh, really?"
"Truly," said the man. "I know nothing, and of my guesses I will not speak. Yet, I will say this much."
Chapter 61. The Stanford Prison Experiment. Secrecy and Openness. Part 11. Through green flame they whirled. Through the flu network they spun, Minerva's heart racing with a pounding horror that she hadn't felt in 10 years and 3 months. The corridors between space coughed and spit them out into the lobby of Gringotts, the safest flu receiver in Diagon Alley, the connection most difficult to intercept, the fastest way out of Hogwarts without a phoenix. A goblin attendant turned toward them. His eyes widened. He began a slightly respectful bow.
"Determination, destination, deliberation!"
And the two of them were in the alley just at the back of Mary's place, wands already out and raised, spinning around, back to back, and the words of an anti-disillusionment charm already rising to Severus's lips. The alley was empty. When she turned back to look at Severus, his wand was already cracking down on his own head with a sound like smashing an egg, as his lips chanted words of invisibility. He took on the colours of his surroundings, became a blur of his surroundings. The blur moved and matched what was behind him, and then there was nothing there. She lowered her wand and stepped forward to receive her own disillusionment. From behind her, the unmistakable sound of a burst of flame. She spun and saw Albus there, his long wand already drawn and raised in his right hand. His eyes were grim beneath the half-circles of his glasses, and forks upon his shoulder had spread his fire-coloured wings in readiness for flight and fight.
"Albus,"
she said.
"I thought..."
She had just seen him depart from Azkaban, and she'd thought not even phoenixes could return from there so easily. Then she realized.
"She escaped," said Albus. "Did your Patronus reach him?"
The pounding in her heart grew stronger. The horror in her veins solidified.
"He said he was here, in the washroom."
"Let us hope he spoke true," said Albus.
The wand tapped her head with a sensation like water trickling over her, and a moment later, the four of them, even Forks had been rendered invisible, though sometimes you saw a flicker of something like fire in his air, were racing to the front of the restaurant. They paused before the door while Albus whispered something. And a moment later, one of the customers, visible through the windows, stood up with a vague look on his face and opened the door, as though taking a quick look outside for some friend. And the three of them were through, racing past the unwitting customers. Severus was marking their faces, Minerva knew, and Albus would see any disillusioned, toward the sign that pointed to the washroom. An old wooden door marked with the sign of a toilet burst open with a slam, and four invisible rescuers stormed through it. The small but clean wooden room was empty. Fresh droplets of water showed in the sink, but there was no sign of Harry. Only a sheet of paper left on the closed lid of the toilet. She couldn't breathe. The sheet of paper rose up into the air as Albus took it, and a moment later was thrust in her own direction.
M. What did the hat tell me to tell you? H.
Ah!
Minerva said aloud in surprise, her mind taking a moment to place the question. It wasn't the sort of thing you'd forget, but she hadn't been thinking in that mode, really.
I'm an impertinent youngster, and I should get off its lawn.
Huh?
Said the heir in Albus's voice, as if even he could be shocked. And then Harry Potter's head appeared, suspended next to the heir beside the toilet. His face was cold and alert, the too adult Harry she'd seen sometimes, eyes darting back and forth and around.
"What's going on?"
the boy began. Albus, now visible once more along with her and Fawkes, was moving forward in an instant. His left hand reached forward and plucked a hair from Harry's head, producing a startled yelp from the boy. Minerva accepted the hair in her own hand, and a moment later Albus swept up the mostly invisible boy in his arms, and there was a flash of red golden fire. And Harry Potter was safe. Minerva took a few steps forward, leaned against the wall where Albus and Harry had been, trying to recover her poise. She'd lost some habits in the 10 years since the Order of the Phoenix had disbanded. Beside her, Severus shimmered into visibility. His right hand was already drawing forth the flask from his robes, his left hand already stretching forth in demand. She gave him Harry's hair, and a moment later it dropped into the flask of unfinished polyjuice, which at once began fizzing and bubbling as it settled into the potency that would enable Severus to act his part as bait.
"That was unexpected,"
the potions master said slowly.
"Why did our headmaster not retrieve Mr. Potter earlier? I wonder if he was going so far as to twist time. There should have been nothing preventing him from doing so. Indeed, your Patronus should have found Mr. Potter already safe."
She hadn't thought of that, a different realization having jumped to the forefront of her mind. It wasn't nearly as horrifying as Bellatrix Black having escaped from Azkaban, but still.
"Harry has an invisibility cloak,"
she said. The potions master did not answer. He was shrinking.
Tick, snick, drip, dip, ding, ring, ting.
It still annoyed her, though it faded past attention after a while, and when, and if, she became headmistress, she intended to silence the whole lot. Which head of Hogwarts, she wondered, had first been so inconsiderate as to create a device that made noise to pass on to their successors. She was sitting in the headmaster's office with a quickly transfigured desk of her own, doing some of the 100 little pieces of necessary paperwork that kept Hogwarts from grinding to a halt. She could lose herself in it easily, and it prevented her from thinking about other things. Albus had once remarked, sounding rather wry, that Hogwarts seemed to run even more smoothly when there was an outside crisis for her to avoid thinking about. 10 years ago. That was the last time Albus had said that. There was the chime that indicated an approaching visitor. Minerva kept reading her current parchment. The door slammed open, revealing Severus Snape, who took 3 steps inward and demanded without the slightest pause,
"Any word from Mad-Eye?"
Albus was already rising from his chair, even as she tucked away her parchments and dispelled the desk.
"Moody's Patronus is reporting to the Me in Azkaban," Albus said. "His eye saw nothing, and if the Eye of Vance does not see a thing, then that thing does not exist. Yourself?"
"No one has tried to forcibly take my blood," Severus said.
He gave a quick grimace of a smile.
"Except the defense professor."
"What?"
said Minerva.
"He saw me for an impostor before I could even open my lips, and quite reasonably attacked me on the spot, demanding to know the whereabouts of Mr. Potter.
Another grimace of a smile.
Shouting that I was Severus Snape did not seem to reassure him for some reason. I do believe that man would kill me for a sickle and give back 5 knuts change. I had to stun our good Professor Quirrell, which was not easy, and then he reacted poorly to the hex. Harry Potter, naturally alarmed, ran out and told the owner, and the defense professor was taken to St. Mungo's.
St. Mungo's?
Which said he had probably been overworking himself for weeks before he collapsed. Such was his state of exhaustion. Your precious defense professor is fine, Minerva. The stunner may have helped him by forcing him to take a few days off. Afterward, I declined the offer of a flu to Hogwarts and went back to Diagon Alley and wandered. But no one seems to have wanted Mr. Potter's blood today.
Our defense professor is in the best of hands, I am sure,
said Albus.
Greater matters command our attention, Minerva.
It took considerable effort for her to wrench her attention back, but she sat back down, and Severus gestured up a chair for himself as well, and the three of them drew together to begin their council. She felt like a polyjuiced impostor, sitting with those two. War was not her art, nor plotting. She had to strain to keep one step ahead of the Weasley twins, and sometimes she failed at that. She was sitting here, ultimately only because she had heard the prophecy.
We are faced,
the headmaster spoke first,
with a rather alarming mystery. I can think of only 2 wizards who might have engineered this escape.
Minerva drew in her breath sharply.
There is a chance it's not you know who.
I'm afraid so,
said the headmaster. She glanced to her side and saw that Severus looked as puzzled as herself. Afraid the Dark Lord was not rising again? She would have given almost anything for that to be true.
So,
Albus said heavily,
our first suspect is Voldemort, risen again and seeking to resurrect himself. I have studied many books I wish I had not read, seeking his every possible avenue of return, and I have found only 3. His strongest road to life is the Philosopher's Stone, which Flamel assures me that not even Voldemort could create on his own. By that road he would rise greater and more terrible than ever before. I would not have thought Voldemort able to resist the temptation of the stone. Still less because such an obvious trap is a challenge to his wit. But his second avenue is nearly as strong. The flesh of his servant willingly given, the blood of his foe forcibly taken, and the bone of his ancestor unknowingly bequeathed. Voldemort is a perfectionist.
Albus glanced at Severus, who nodded in agreement.
And he would certainly seek the most powerful combination. The flesh of Bellatrix Black, the blood of Harry Potter, and the bone of his father. Voldemort's final avenue is to seduce a victim and drain the life from them over a long period, in which case Voldemort would be weak compared to his former power. His motive to spirit away Bellatrix is clear, and if he is keeping her in reserve, to use
only in case he cannot attain the stone. That would explain why no kidnapped attempt was made on Harry this day."
Minerva glanced at Severus, saw him listening attentively, but without surprise.
"What is not clear," the headmaster continued, "is how Voldemort could have engineered this escape. A death doll was left in Bellatrix's place. Her escape was meant to be undetected. And even though that went wrong, the Dementors could not find her after their first warning. Azkaban has stood impenetrable for centuries, and I cannot imagine any means by which Voldemort could have accomplished this."
"That may mean little," Severus said, expressionless. "For the Dark Lord to do what we cannot imagine requires only that he has a better imagination."
Albus nodded grimly.
"Unfortunately, there is now another wizard who laughs at impossibilities. A wizard who, not long ago, developed a new and powerful charm which could have blinded the Dementors to Bellatrix Black's escape. And he is implicated for other reasons as well."
Minerva's heart was skipping beats. She didn't know how or why, but a terrible apprehension was dawning on her as to who.
"Who would that be?" said Severus, sounding puzzled.
Albus leaned back and said the fatal words, even as she had feared them.
"Harry James Potter Evans Verus."
"Potter?"
demanded the potions master, as much shock in that usually silken voice as she had ever heard from him.
"Headmaster, is this one of your jokes? He is in his first year at Hogwarts. A temper tantrum and a few childish pranks with an invisibility cloak does not make him."
"It is no joke,"
said Minerva, her voice barely above a whisper.
"Harry is already making original discoveries in Transfiguration, Severus. Though I did not know he was researching charms as well."
"Harry is no ordinary first year," the headmaster said solemnly. "He is marked as the Dark Lord's equal, and he has power the Dark Lord knows not."
Severus was looking at her, and you would have needed to know him well to recognize that his glance was pleading.
"Am I to take this seriously?"
Minerva simply nodded.
"Does anyone else know of this new and powerful charm?" Severus demanded.
The headmaster glanced at her apologetically. Somehow, she knew. She knew before he even said it, and she wanted to scream at the top of her lungs, and said,
"Quirinus Quirrell."
"Why?"
she said in a voice that should have melted half the devices in the office.
"Did Mr. Potter even tell our defense professor about this brilliant new charm for breaking out of prisons?"
The headmaster passed a weary, wrinkled hand across his equally wrinkled forehead.
"Quirinus just happened to be there, Minerva. Even I saw no harm in it at the time."
The headmaster hesitated.
"And Harry said his charm was too dangerous to be explained to either of us. And when I asked him again this day, he insisted he had still not explained it to Quirinus, nor had he ever dropped his occlumency barriers in the defense professor's presence."
"Mr. Potter is an occlumens, You gave him an invisibility cloak, and he's immune to Veritaserum, and he's friends with the Weasley twins. Albus, do you have any idea what you unleashed upon this school?
Her voice was nearly shrieking now.
By his seventh year, there won't be anything left of Hogwarts but a smoking hole in the ground.
Albus leaned back in his great cushioned chair and said, smiling,
"Don't forget the time, Turner."
She did scream then, but quietly. Severus drawled,
"Should I teach him to brew polyjuice, Headmaster? I ask only for the sake of completeness, in case you are not satisfied with the magnitude of your pet disaster."
"Perhaps next year," said Albus. "My dearest friends, the question before us is whether Harry Potter has spirited Bellatrix Black out of Azkaban, which is more than youthful high spirits, even by my tolerant standards."
"Excuse me, Headmaster," Severus said, with one of
the driest smiles she had ever seen him deliver to Albus.
"But I will register my opinion that the answer is no. This is the Dark Lord's work, pure and simple."
"Then why?"
Albus said, and now there was no humour at all in his voice.
"When I planned to retrieve Harry immediately after his arrival in Diagon Alley, did I find that this would result in paradox?"
Minerva sank further back into her chair, dropped her left elbow onto the hardest, uncushioned armrest, leaned her head into her hand, and shut her eyes in despair. There was a narrowly circulated proverb to the effect that only one aura in 30 was qualified to investigate cases involving time-turners, and that of those few, the half who weren't already insane soon would be.
"So, you suspect," Severus's voice was saying, "that Potter went from Diagon Alley to Azkaban, then looped back to Diagon Alley afterward to be picked up by us?"
"Precisely," said Albus's voice. "Though it is also possible that Voldemort or his servants watched to make sure Harry did arrive in Diagon Alley before they began their attempt on Azkaban, and that they had someone with a time-turner who would send back the message of their success to trigger the abduction. Indeed, it was my suspicion of this possibility that caused me to dispatch you and Minerva on your own mission before I myself went to Azkaban. I thought then that their breakout would fail, but if retrieving Harry Potter meant observing the fact of their eventual failure, then I myself could not have gone to Azkaban after I had interacted with him, for Azkaban's future cannot touch its past. When in Azkaban, I received no report from you or Minerva, nor from Flitwick, whom I told to try contacting you. I knew that your interaction with Harry Potter had been an interaction with Azkaban's future, meaning that someone was sending messages through time."
Then Albus's voice stopped.
"But, Headmaster," said Severus, "you came back from Azkaban's future and interacted with us."
The potion master's voice trailed off.
"But, Severus, if I had received reports from you and Minerva of Harry's safety, I would not, in the first place, have gone backwards in time to—"
"Headmaster, I think we must draw diagrams for this.
I agree, Severus.
There was the sound of parchment being spread on a table, and then quills scratching, and more arguing. Minerva sat in her chair, head resting in her hand, eyes shut. There was a story she'd once heard about a criminal who had possessed a time-turner, which the Department of Mysteries had sealed to him, in a case of extremely bad judgment as to who needed one, and there had been an aura assigned to track down this unknown time-criminal, who had also been given a time-turner. And the story ended with both of them in St. Mungo's ward for totally unrecoverable nutcases. Minerva sat there with her eyes shut, trying not to listen, trying not to think about it, and trying not to go insane. After a while, when the argument seemed to have wound down, she said aloud,
"Mr. Potter's time turner is restricted to the hours of 9 p.m. through midnight. Was the shell tampered with, Elbus?"
"Not to my most discerning charms," said Albus. "But the shells are new things, and to defeat the Unspeakable's precautions and leave no trace of the defeat might not be impossible."
She opened her eyes and saw Severus and the headmaster staring intently at a parchment covered with tangled squiggles that would have no doubt driven her mad to comprehend.
"Have you come to any conclusions?"
Minerva said.
"And please don't tell me how you arrived at them."
Severus and the headmaster looked at each other, then turned to look at her.
"We have concluded," the headmaster said gravely, "that either Harry was involved, or he was not. That either Voldemort has access to a time-turner, or he does not. And that regardless of what could have happened within Azkaban, nobody would have visited the little Hangleton Graveyard during the period Moody has already watched over it within my own past."
"In short," Severus drawled, "we know nothing, dear Minerva, though it seems at least likely that another time-turner was involved somehow. My own suspicion is that Potter has been bribed, tricked, or threatened into conveying messages backward in time, perhaps even regarding this very prison break. I shall not make the obvious suggestion as to who is pulling his strings, but I suggest that at 9 o'clock tonight we test whether Potter is able to travel the full 6 hours backward to 3 o'clock, to see if he has yet used his time-turner."
"That seems wise to do in any case," said Dumbledore. "See that done, Minerva, and tell Harry to stop in my office at his convenience afterward."
"But you still suspect Harry of direct involvement in the prison break itself?"
Minerva said.
"Possible, but unlikely," said Severus, at the same time Albus said,
"Yes."
Minerva pinched the bridge of her nose, took a deep breath, let it out.
"Albus, Severus, what possible reason has Mr. Potter to do such a thing?"
"None that I can think of," said Albus. "But it remains that Harry's magics alone, of all the means known to me, might have..."
"Hold,"
said Severus. All expression vanished from his face.
"A thought occurs to me. I must check..."
The potion's master seized a pinch of flue powder, strode across the room toward the fireplace. Albus hastily waved his wand to light it, and then in a glare of green flame, and the words,
"Slytherin Head of House Office!"
Severus was gone. She and Albus looked at each other, and both shrugged, and then Albus turned back to studying the parchment. It was only a few minutes later that Severus spun back out of the flue, brushing traces of ash from himself.
"Well,"
said the potions master, again the expressionless face.
"I am afraid that Mr. Potter does have motive."
"Speak," said Albus.
"I found Lysarth Lestrange in the Slytherin common room studying," Severus said. "He was not reluctant to meet my eyes, and it seems that Mr. Lestrange did not like to think of his parents in Azkaban. The cold and the darkness, with the Dementors sucking away their life, hurting every second of every day, and he told Mr. Potter so in as many words, and begged him to get them out. Since, you see, Mr. Lestrange had heard that the boy who lived could do anything."
She and Albus exchanged glances.
"Severus,"
Minerva said,
"surely even Harry has more common sense than that."
Her voice trailed off.
"Mr. Potter thinks he is God," Severus said without expression, "and Lysarth Lestrange fell to his knees before him in a heartfelt cry of prayer."
Minerva stared at Severus, feeling sick to her stomach. She had studied Muggle religion. It was the most common reason for needing to memory charm the parents of Muggleborns, and she knew enough to understand what Severus had just said.
"In any case,"
said the potions master,
"I looked within Mr. Lestrange to see if he knew anything of his mother's escape. He has heard nothing. But the instant he learns, he will conclude that the person responsible was Harry Potter."
"I see," Albus said slowly. "Thank you, Severus. That is good news."
"Good news?"
Minerva burst out. Albus looked at her, his face as expressionless as Severus's now, and she remembered, with a shock, that Albus's own.
"It is the best reason I can possibly imagine for removing Bellatrix from Azkaban," Albus said quietly. "And if it is not, Harry, let us recall, then it is certainly Voldemort himself making his first moves. But let us not be hasty in judgment while there is much we do not yet know, but soon will."
Albus once more stood up from behind his desk, strode to the fireplace still alight, cast in another pinch of green powder, and stuck his head into the flames.
"Department of Magical Law Enforcement," he said. "Director's Office."
After a moment, the voice of Madame Bones came through clear and sharp.
"What is it, Albus? I am somewhat busy."
"Amelia," said Albus, "I beg of you to share any discoveries you have made concerning this matter."
There was a pause.
"Oh,"
said the cold voice of Madame Bones from the blazing fire.
"And is that a two-way road then, Albus?"
"It may be,"
the old wizard said calmly.
"If any aura dies of your reticence, old meddler, I will hold you responsible in full measure."
I understand, Amelia, Albus said. But I have no wish to spark needless alarm and incredulity.
Bellatrix Black has escaped from Azkaban! What alarm or incredulity do you think I will call needless in the face of that?
I may call on you to remember those words, said the old wizard into the green flames. For if I learn that my fears are not needless, I will tell you. Now, Amelia, I beg you, if you have learned anything whatsoever upon this matter, please share it.
There was another pause, and then Madame Bones's voice said,
I have information which I learned 4 hours into the future, Albus. Do you still want it?
Albus paused. Weighing, Minerva knew, the possibility that he might want to go back more than 2 hours from this instant, for you couldn't send information further back in time than 6 hours, not through any chain of time-turners. And finally said,
Yes, please.
We had a lucky break, said Madame Bones's voice. One of the Aurors who witnessed the escape was a Muggle-born, and she told us that the Flying Fire Spell, as we were calling it, might be no spell at all, but a Muggle artifact.
Like a punch in the stomach. That was how it felt, and the sickness in Minerva's belly redoubled. Anyone who'd watched a Chaos Legion battle knew whose hand that showed. Madame Bones's voice continued.
We brought in Arthur Weasley from Misuse of Muggle Artifacts. He knows more about Muggle Artifacts than any wizard alive, and gave him the descriptions from the auras on the scene, and he cracked it. It was a Muggle artifact called a rocker, and they called it that because you have to be off your rocker to ride one. Just 6 years ago, one of their rockers blew up, killed hundreds of Muggles in a flash, and almost set fire to the moon. Weasley says that rockers use a special kind of science called opposite reaction. So, the plan is to develop a jinx which will prevent that science from working around Azkaban.
Thank you, Amelia, Albus said gravely. Is that everything?
I will check if we have anything from 6 hours forward, said the voice of Madame Bones. If so, they wouldn't have told me, but I'll have them tell you. Do you have anything you want to tell me, Albus? Which of those two possibilities is it looking like?
Not yet, Amelia, Albus said, but I may have word for you soon.
He straightened up from the fire then, which faded back to ordinary yellow flames. Every minute of the old wizard's years, every natural second since his birth, and every second which time-turning had added, all of that, plus a few extra decades for stress, was visible on his lined face.
Severus, the old wizard said, what was it actually?
A rocket, said the half-blood potions master, who had grown up in the Muggle town of Spinner's End. One of the most impressive Muggle technologies.
Who likely is Harry to do such arts?
Said Minerva. Severus drawled.
Oh, a boy like Mr. Potter knows all about rockets. That, dear Minerva, is a certainty. You must remember that things are done differently in the Muggle world,
Severus frowned.
But rockets are dangerous and expensive.
Harry has stolen and hidden an unknown amount of money from his Gringotts vault. Perhaps thousands of galleons,
said the headmaster, and then to their twin stares,
That was not in my plan, but I made the mistake of sending the defense professor to supervise Harry's withdrawal of 5 galleons for Christmas presents."
The headmaster shrugged.
"Yes, I agree. Sheer folly in retrospect. Let us continue."
Minerva quietly thudded her head a few times against the headrest of her chair.
"None the less, headmaster," Severus said. "Just because the Death Eaters never used Muggle artifacts in the First War, that does not mean he is ignorant. Rockets fell on Britain as well in the Muggle side of Grindelwald's War. If he spent the summers of those years in a Muggle orphanage, as you told us, headmaster, then he too has heard of rockets. And if he has been listening to reports of Mr. Potter and his mock battles using Muggle artifacts, he would certainly learn his enemy's strengths and try to redouble them himself. That is just how he thinks. Any power he sees, he will try to take for his own."
The old wizard was standing stock still, utterly motionless, even the hairs of his beard frozen in place like solid wires, and the thought came to Minerva, as frightening as any thought she'd ever had, that Albus Dumbledore was rooted to the spot in horror.
"Severus," Albus said, and his voice almost cracked. "Do you realize what you're saying? If Harry Potter and Voldemort fight their war with Muggle weapons, there will be nothing left of the world but fire."
"What?"
said Minerva. She had heard of guns, of course, but they weren't that dangerous to an experienced witch. Severus spoke as though she weren't in the room.
"Then perhaps, headmaster, he is sending a deliberate warning to Harry Potter of exactly that, saying that any attack with Muggle weapons will be met with retaliation in kind. Command Mr. Potter to cease his use of Muggle technology in his battles. That will show him the message is received, and not give him any more ideas."
Severus frowned.
"Though, come to think of it, Mr. Malfoy, and of course Miss Granger, well, on second thought, a blanket prohibition on technology seems wiser."
The old wizard pressed both his hands to his forehead, and from his lips came an unsteady voice.
"I begin to hope that it is Harry behind this escape. Oh, Merlin, defend us all! What have I done? What have I done? What will become of the world?"
Severus shrugged.
"From the rumors I've heard, headmaster, Muggle weapons are only slightly worse than the more recondite aspects of wizardry."
"Worse!"
gasped Minerva, and then shut her mouth as though by force.
"Worse than any peril left in these fading years," said Albus. "Not worse than that which erased Atlantis from time."
Minerva stared at him, feeling the sweat break out all along her spine. Severus continued, still addressing Albus.
"All the Death Eaters, save Bellatrix, would have betrayed him. All his supporters turned against him. All the powers of the world converged to destroy him if he had been reckless with any truly dangerous potency. Is this so different, then?
Some motion, some colour, had returned to the old wizard's face.
Perhaps not.
And in any case,
Severus said with a slightly condescending smile,
Muggle weapons are not so easy to obtain, not for 1,000 galleons or 1,000,000.
Doesn't Harry just transfigure the devices he uses in his battles?
Thought Minerva, but before she could open her mouth to ask, the fireplace erupted in green flames then, and the face of Pius Thicknessy, Madam Bones's assistant, appeared therein.
Chief Warlock, said Thicknessy, I have a report for ye, transmitted from...
Thicknessy's eyes flickered over Minerva and Severus.
6 minutes ago.
6 hours ahead, you mean, said Albus. These two are meant to hear it. Deliver your report.
We know how it was done, said Thicknessy. In Bellatrix Black's cell, hidden in one corner, was a potions vial, and testing the traces of remaining fluid shows that it was an Aramegas potion.
There was a long pause.
I see, Albus said heavily.
Pardon me,
said Minerva. She didn't. Thicknessy's head turned toward her.
Animagi, Madam McGonagall, in their Animagus forms, are of less interest to the mentors. All prisoners are tested before their arrival at Azkaban, and if they're Animagi, their Animagus form is destroyed. But we had not considered that someone protected by a Patronus charm while taking the potion and performing the meditation might be able to become an Animagus after they went to Azkaban.
I understood, Severus said, having by now put on his customary sneer, that the Animagus meditation requires considerable time.
Well, Mr. Snape,
Thicknessy barked,
records show that Bellatrix Black was an Animagus before she was sentenced to Azkaban and her form destroyed. So, maybe her second meditation didn't take as much time as her first.
I would not have thought it possible for any prisoner of Azkaban to do such a thing,
Albus said.
But Bellatrix Black was a most powerful sorceress before her incarceration, and she might have done it if any witch could. Can Azkaban be secured against this method?
Yes,
said the confident head of Pius Thicknessy.
Our experiment says that it's nigh unimaginable that an Animagus meditation could be performed in less than 3 hours, regardless of experience. All visits to prisoners allowed to receive them will be limited to 2 hours henceforth, and the Dementors will inform us if any Patronus charm is maintained in the prison areas for longer than that.
Albus looked unhappy at that, but nodded.
I see. There will be no further attempts of that sort, of course, but do not relax your vigilance. And when Amelia has been told all this, tell her that I have information for her.
The head of Pius Thicknessy vanished without another word.
No further attempts,
said Minerva.
Because, dear Minerva,
Severus drawled, having not quite taken off his habitual sneer.
If the Dark Lord had planned to free any of his other servants from Azkaban, he would not have left behind the vial of potion to tell us how it was done.
Severus frowned.
I confess, even so, I do not see why that vial was left there.
It is some kind of message,
Albus said slowly.
And I cannot see what it means. Not at all.
He drummed his fingers on his desk. For a long minute, or three, the old wizard stared off into nothingness, frowning. Well, Severus also sat in silence. Then Albus shook his head in dismay and said,
"Severus, do you comprehend this?"
"No," said the potions master, and with a sardonic smile, "which is probably all the better for us. Whatever we are intended to conclude from it, that part of his plan has misfired."
"You are certain now that it is, you know, that it is Voldemort,"
said Minerva.
"It could not have been that some other Death Eater conceived this clever notion."
"And they knew about rockets, too," Severus said dryly. "I don't believe the other Death Eaters were so fond of Muggle studies. It is he."
"Aye, it is he," Albus said. "Azkaban has endured impenetrable for ages, only to fall to an ordinary animagus potion. It is too clever and too impossible, which was ever Voldemort's signature since the days he was known as Tom Riddle. Anyone who wished to forge that signature must need be as cunning as Voldemort himself to do so. And there is no one else in the world who would accidentally overestimate